Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. The president is tweeting conspiracy theories. I know that sounds like Groundhog Day, but specifically we're going to get to that in a moment. Also, we have a new poll out this morning from the Washington Post Schar School, which says that Americans are overwhelmingly supporting the nationwide protests that have taken place since the killing of George Floyd at the hands of the Minneapolis police. A big majority say the police forces have not done enough to ensure that blacks are treated equally to whites. And President Trump just gets hammered once again in this poll. Trump receives negative marks for his handling of the protests, with 61% saying they disapprove, 35% saying they approve. But a lot of the opposition to Trump is really strong, is really vehement. 47% of Americans say they strongly disapprove of the way the president has responded to the protests. Now, as I'm looking at all of these developments over the last couple of days, I was reading in Politico magazine a rather extraordinary piece by Tim Alberta. Is this the last stand of the law and order Republicans? Is this the moment in which the Republican playing of the law and order card comes to an end? So I'd actually reached out to my producer. I said, is there any way that we actually could get Tim Alberta to come back on the podcast sometime this week? And Jim Swift says, well, interesting, you should ask, because we've already booked him for tomorrow morning. And he joins us now. Good to have you back, Tim.
Guys, always great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
So as I was mentioning to you right before we started all of this, you know, I have been around for so long that I keep thinking that the default setting of the electorate is going to go to the law and order, that the backlash would set in about the violence and the excesses. And I think that that's what the Republican, you know, that's the Republican Party playbook, right? That's what Donald Trump is simply assuming, all of his tweets, all of his comments. And something different's happening right now, isn't it?
I certainly think so, Charlie. And you could look at it from any number of different angles. You know, the one that I was really trying to focus on in the piece was just this, I think, sort of basic rhetorical question, even if it's not a policy issue at the forefront for many Republicans. There's at least this question about the way you talk on issues of race in America, on the justice system specifically, but really, you know, questions of institutional inequality across the board. And, you know, obviously there's been this almost punchline for years among Republicans about, you know, no apology, right? You know, Obama went on his apology tour around the world talking about everything America had done wrong, and Republicans and conservatives really recoil from that kind of talk. But I think it's worth realizing that those same rules apply domestically, right? If you are going to question the integrity of America's institutions, specifically, you know, the criminal justice system, that is a non-starter for so many Republicans, at least it has been for a really long time. And so to even question whether there is systemic discrimination against minorities in this country, that's just something that most Republicans have never wanted to go anywhere near. And really, it's what made it so extraordinary when last week, former President George W. Bush issued this very emotional statement in which he was really calling into question America's institutions as they pertain to race. And he asked, you know, how do we deal with this systemic racism in America? And boy, he uncorked all of this pent up anger and frustration and resentment from a lot of folks on the right, who some of your sort of former running mates, Charlie, people in talk radio, the Mark Levin crowd, the Laura Ingraham crowd, who were just disgusted to hear George W. Bush give voice to that phrase, systemic racism, and to talk about America's institutions in this way. But I think Bush is really onto something here, and it's not just political. There is a real cultural groundswell now where even a lot of self-identified conservatives, a lot of white conservatives, are now beginning to question these long-held assumptions about these institutions and really about these core questions surrounding racial inequality in America.
Yeah, you document the blowback that Bush got from the usual suspects. Mark Levin said that Bush sounds like an idiot. Byron York, Washington Examiner columnist, found it remarkable that Bush almost completely ignored the riots and violence. That's what he had to say. Laura Ingraham, predictably. retweeted a Washington Times excerpt that read, "It's been 6 years since the Ferguson riots put a microscope on relations between police and Black communities. And despite dozens of studies, researchers say they are no closer to a consensus on the role that bias and racism play." And, you know, again, I haven't listened to him, but I'm guessing that Limbaugh said the same thing. Tucker Carlson had an interesting monologue and seems to be exactly what you're talking about here last night, where Tucker Carlson goes on Fox News and says that this is not really about Black lives at all, and repeats that mantra of don't apologize. This is what Tucker Carlson had to say last night.
"When they come for you, and at this rate, they will. Anyone who's ever been subjected to the rage of the mob knows the feeling. It's like being swarmed by hornets. You cannot think clearly. And the temptation is to panic, but you can't panic. You've got to keep your head and tell the truth. Tell the truth. If you show weakness of any kind, they will crush you. Ask Drew Brees. By some accounts, poor Drew Brees is on his fourth apology for the crime of defending the American flag. He decided to apologize, and now they're using him as a propaganda organ, hostage tape after hostage tape. At a moment like this, there is no advantage in cowardice, in being Mitt Romney. You think you're saving yourself, you're just empowering the worst people, people who hate you. Before you know it, you're confessing to crimes you didn't commit. Don't start. Tell the truth. And the truth is, this is a good country."
Wow. He goes on to mention Mitt Romney being a coward, saying that this is not about Black lives. But that's the playbook, isn't it, Tim? That's Tucker Carlson just went back to the document of the Republican Party since at least 1968.
Yeah, he did. And look, for good reason, Charlie, let's be clear about this. I mean, there is a change of foot in the Republican Party slowly. But it's going to take a while to catch up. And you know, this is what I really get into in the piece, not to make it explicitly political, but let's be real. I mean, these folks are politicians who were watching handle these crises, and some of them are going to run for president one day, and some of them are going to attempt to take over the post-Trump Republican Party. And there is a really fascinating fault line emerging between the likes of a Tom Cotton and a Ted Cruz at one poll versus maybe a Nikki Haley, a Will Hurd, maybe even a Marco Rubio at the other poll. And a lot of folks obviously falling on that spectrum in between. But, you know, this is just like the question that was posed by Reince Priebus and the Republican National Committee after Romney lost in 2012, which is like, how do we win elections in a rapidly diversifying America? How do we appeal to non-traditional Republican voters who have not been receptive to most of our messages because they can't even get past sort of these you know, these threshold issues with us about, you know, about race and about identity in America and our belonging to the American idea? And so this plays into these same sort of demographic transition arguments about, look, for the short term, yes, Donald Trump can win with, you know, less than 30% of the non-white vote nationally. Donald Trump can win by juicing, you know, non-college educated white working class voters and their turnout numbers across the board. Sure, that strategy can win in the short term, the same way that Tucker Carlson's rhetoric is going to work in the short term because the numbers are still on his side. But as this thing starts to transition and that transition begins to accelerate, and we're seeing that now, the numbers bear it out, there's going to be a real reckoning inside the Republican Party. And it's not a matter of if, it's just a matter of when. And it might not be, you know, for another 5 years, 10 years, maybe even 20 years. Who knows? These things can move slowly. But, you know, Frank Luntz yesterday tweeted my story, and he was referring to some of the poll numbers I had in there, Charlie. I don't want to ramble, but let me read these poll numbers.
No. They're very dramatic.
They're unbelievable. So, the question of do police use excessive force against African Americans more than they use excessive force against white Americans? The people who believe that, yes, that is true, that police are more likely to use excessive force against Black people than against white people. In 2014, after the death of Eric Garner in New York City, that number was only 33% of all Americans believed that, and only 26% of white Americans believed that. That was 6 years ago. Fast forward to the summer of 2020, Monmouth asked that same question. 57% of Americans believe that, yes, the police are more likely to use excessive force against black people than against white people. And among whites, 49% believe that. So in a matter of 6 years, the number among whites jumped from 26% believing it to 49% believing it. And Frank Luntz tweeted this out yesterday for my story, and he said, I've been polling for 30 years, and I've never seen movement like this. So clearly, there are some Republicans who believe that in the short term, it is going to be politically advantageous to stick to that more traditionalist, hard ass, as Karl Rove called it, law and order position. But the ground is shifting beneath their feet.
No, and you quote Karl Rove as basically saying we can't keep playing that card again. And to hear that from Karl Rove, I thought was rather striking.
Yeah, right. Look, Karl Rove has his ear to the ground like nobody in the party. I mean, this is not somebody who is prone to making dramatic statements for the sake of making dramatic statements. And he said, look, this is just not really sustainable. I didn't quote him on this part in the piece, but we were talking about that continuum of Republicans that, you know, the spectrum from, you know, Tom Cotton at one end to maybe Tim Scott at the other end. And he said, look, you know, moving forward, I know what side I'd want to be on. Like, this is just, the numbers are clear and the cultural momentum is clear. And when Karl Rove says something like that, you know, people sit up and pay attention. So it's going to be really interesting, I think, Charlie. You know, in 2024, you are already going to have these questions inside the Republican primary among all of these ambitious politicians about expanding the appeal of the GOP in the post-Trump age. And that's in talking about immigration. It's in talking about all kinds of things. But this question about talking about law enforcement and institutional inequality and systemic racism, those questions were nowhere to be found in the Republican Party as of about 2 weeks ago. And suddenly, I think they're going to be very much central to this broader question about how do we reach out and bring, you know, minority voters into the tent of the GOP.
I just think that's going to be extraordinarily difficult coming out of the Trump years and saying that wasn't us. Because we're still at the beginning of this. It feels like we're at the beginning of this. And you know that Trump is going to be doubling down and tripling down on this. And for an entire generation of Americans, the face of the Republican Party is going to be Donald Trump, who is at the far end of the spectrum. Before we get into that, though, so I'm going to go back to these poll numbers, because I did see the Frank Luntz tweet about how dramatic it is, and they are remarkable. It really is remarkable, and it defies, I think, a lot of the expectations of the hardliners. What do you think is happening? Why has public opinion shifted this far, this fast on this issue? Is it just because simply we are seeing videotapes?
I think
there's something else.
With the caveat up front that I'm not a social scientist and that I have not taken pains to do research into this, Charlie, look, I think that's a huge part of it. I used the phrase digital proximity in the piece, and I think that's really so much of this is that for a really long time, you might read about these things, you might hear about them on talk radio, or you might even see a clip of them on the nightly news, but you're not seeing, you know, 8 minutes and 45 seconds of a black man having a white police officer kneel on his neck while the black man is begging for his life and calling out for his mother. And then you watch him die literally on video. I mean, that's just not something that we were exposed to as, and I don't mean we as in voters generally, I mean we as in white people specifically, right? Like there's, and this is not to just polarize it along those racial lines. But I do think that obviously this has not been a part of the white experience, you know, speaking in the broadest possible terms. I mean, sure, you'll see people on the right in recent weeks tweeting out stories about white people dying at the hands of police. Right. Does that happen? Sure it does, of course. I mean, you have lethal run-ins with police all the time, whether you're black, white, or purple. I mean, that's to be expected. But again, this idea of disproportionate brutality toward minority communities and specifically toward the Black community is something that had been, I think, long discussed, and there were some numbers to substantiate it, but people could never really wrap their arms around it. And I do feel like, you know, when you turn on these videos now in the last 5 or 6 years, whether it's the Philando Castile video, or whether it's Eric Garner in New York City, or obviously this most recent terrible video with George Floyd, it just, I think, is eye-opening to people in a way that no other, you know, there's just nothing else that could move people emotionally in that same medium.
Well, let me test a thought out on you and see whether you agree. Because I agree with everything you say here, but I also feel that there's something going on right now, not just in the last five or six years, but in the last 5 or 6 days. And it's the same thing. It is the videos that people are watching. And I think that for a lot of whites, certainly a lot of conservative whites, they looked at the videos in the past and they thought, okay, that's an isolated incident. It's a bad apple here or there. That person's not me. Well, this wouldn't have happened if this person had complied or had not been engaging in this activity. So it's easy to distance and say that is somebody happening to somebody else, probably isolated. And then what people would fall back on their own experience with police, which is generally positive. However, in the last 5 or 6 days, you have seen how widespread for lack of a better phrase, police misconduct is. I mean, yes, there's rioting. Yes, there is unrest. But for me, the genuinely shocking things are watching the number of incidents in which cops are clearly abusing their power. And that's happening to people who could be like my kids, who could be like people that I associate with. And in fact, there is no context for it. And it raises the question, are we dealing with a handful of bad apples? Or is this, in fact, much more deeply ingrained in the culture of policing? So yes, over the last 5 or 6 years, the numbers have moved dramatically. But over the last 5 or 6 days, when I would have expected that there would have been the backlash against the fires and the rioting, the backlash appears to be like, whoa, look at these cops. This is disturbing. And I've been hearing that from a lot of the kind of people who in the past would have put the I back the badge, you know, signs in front of their house during a moment like this.
Charlie, all of that is true. And it's well said. And I want to be clear. The internet can be a wonderful thing and it can be a really dangerous thing, right? Because you tend to see the worst in people, and we do tend to amplify both the voices and the videos and the images that are kind of the most striking, but usually also the most unusual or kind of atypical. And so, look, there is no question that for a lot of Americans, including Americans who are, at their core, very supportive of law enforcement because they understand it's inherently a difficult job and they back the blue, they back the badge. They have seen, you know, the stringing together of incident after incident after incident over the last couple of weeks. And they are, I think, genuinely alarmed and genuinely rethinking their long-held position on, okay, this is just a few bad apples. Now, that's not to suddenly say that they think that the entire orchard is rotten by any means, but I think that some folks are definitely beginning to come to the realization that, you know, maybe there are some structural issues here with training, with sort of compliance, with regulations, with the sort of processes by which these folks are written up or are questioned about, you know, incidents that have come up. I mean, how many times did this cop in Minnesota have to get rung up on allegations of misconduct, and yet he's still on the streets? I think that kind of thing is alarming to people. And that really, Charlie, should be a nonpartisan issue. I mean, there's nothing more classically liberal than questioning state power, right? And you know, I have law enforcement in my family. I've got a bunch of friends who are in law enforcement. Like, and traditionally, whenever you have one of these episodes, I know it almost sounds cliche at this point, but whenever you have one of these high-profile episodes that really blows up, those are the first guys who I'll see sort of shaking their head and feeling disgusted by it and saying, look, like this is just some jackass. This is some idiot who doesn't know how to do the job. And now I just wonder if we are politically capable of, you know, stepping back and having that bigger conversation about, okay, what does need to be done to avoid these incidents in the future? Or is it just going to be nakedly politicized?
Okay, let's flip the script a little bit. We've been talking about the Republicans. The Democrats have had an interesting 48 hours where we had moved from this discussion of the need to reform the police department to confront these possibly systemic racism of the law enforcement system, to the slogan to defund the police, to dismantle the police, to abolish the police. And I say 48 hours because Joe Biden, with I would say unwanted speed, came out and said, no, I'm not in favor of defunding the police. I want to reform the police. But you could tell that in the Republican playbook, this was what they were grasping on. OK, so maybe they were losing the debate for all the reasons that you've been describing, but that the left was overplaying their hand and had handed them a very useful slogan that the radical left is out of control and they want to defund the police. So how does that play?
Oh, you know, it's so, look, I would say this first, Charlie. The former Speaker of the House, John Boehner, had this great saying, and he would repeat it ad nauseum to his members. He'd say, when your opponent is committing suicide, don't shoot him.
Yes.
And the left seems intent in situations like this on trying to shoot Donald Trump, on trying to shoot the Republican Party, when clearly they are, as you said, losing the argument. I mean, you only have to look at just the horse race polling. Forget about the approved, disapproved, forget about the favorable impressions of the president's handling of this whole crisis. The gap in the horse race numbers tells that whole story. I mean, the president is really against the ropes now, and he has been for the last couple of weeks, but boy, it's really gotten worse in the last, you know, 96 hours of polling. And what better lifeline to get tossed than this idea of defunding the police, of dismantling the police? Now, to be clear, this is coming from some pretty fringe elements of the progressive base. It is not being embraced by the mainstream of the Democratic Party, but it's already, in my view, got more legs than Abolish ICE did, in the sense that, you know, yep, we saw what the Minneapolis City Council did this week. We've seen, you know, people like Brian Fallon tweeting defund the police. You know, Brian Fallon is a high-profile character in the Democratic Party, somebody who's been central to major Democratic players in the last 10 years. And so when he tweets something like that, when he's in on that slogan, it does mean something. And
so not fringe.
It's, well, look, and I think the question really, Charlie, is, you know, people have been adamant in the last 24 hours here saying, well, look, there's a lot of nuance in this. There's a lot of policy nuance. That's fine, but if you're going to use a slogan like defund the police, you have to recognize that 8 out of 10 voters are never going to get past the slogan itself. They're not going to read some piece in The Atlantic talking about, you know, the shades of gray here and what it really means to defund the police and how this is really about, you know, resourcing priorities. No, I mean, look, slogans and symbolism in politics really matter. And so, you know, people weren't interested in the intricacies of building the wall being really about sort of repairing some fencing. No, if you're going to chant build the wall, that means something. And so this is the same thing. And I do think the Democratic Party has to be very, very careful in how they message on something like this, not only because they've got Donald Trump against the ropes, but because there's always going to be this trade-off between energizing your base and capturing the middle of the electorate. And for a lot of Democrats in the last 6 months, there's been this big question about intensity in the base. And these poll numbers that we're seeing now, Charlie, that you were citing at the top about the very unfavorable impressions of Donald Trump handling this crisis, that's your intensity. You don't need additional intensity at this point. You need to capture the center. And anything that starts to flirt with this notion of, you know, dismantling local police departments, that's going to scare the hell out of an awful lot of suburban soccer moms.
Well, that's exactly it. I mean, it struck me as really bad politics and policy. I mean, the politics you just described, anytime your message is almost guaranteed to be misunderstood, it's bad politics. And in terms of policy, if you really want to reinvent, reform the police department to change many of these practices, that actually might cost more money. It might actually mean more resources to get that. But I think, again, Biden was able to back off from it. The Democrats in Congress are trying to pivot to their own bill, which no longer seems that radical. But this is another moment for, I would hope that the Democrats would remind themselves again, that Twitter is not real life. It is not the real world. But this was an unforced error. And I have to tell you how many times I got fed back to me over the last couple of days. People saying, so if we elect a Democratic Congress, they're actually going to defund the police. And by the way, listening to the explanations, you mentioned the Minneapolis City Council, the Minneapolis City Council president who goes on CNN and is asked very directly, well, what about somebody who is lying at home and, you know, someone's breaking into their house and who should they call if you don't have a police department? And she says that comes from a position of privilege. This could not be more tone deaf. This could not be more tone deaf. This is the one sort of position that feeds into every negative stereotype of the left. But so far, it hasn't shown up in these top line polls.
Yeah, I mean, look, Charlie, you say tone deaf. I say nuts. I mean,
okay. Look, that'd be nice.
I mean, look, yeah, you're way too nice. I mean, look, maybe this woman, the president of the city council in Minneapolis, maybe she didn't have her coffee before she went on the show. Maybe she really had a bad night's sleep. I don't know what the explanation is, but to say something like that on national television is just so, it's nutty. I mean, and to your point, I mean, this isn't just about like the worst stereotypes of left. This is out of the fever dreams of conservatives that
absolutely.
People breaking into our house are really just misunderstood, right? That we don't need to call the police because that is it, that we are then exercising some degree of privilege, and the people who are breaking in are really the ones that they are entitled to our property. We should really just shouldn't be in this house in the first place. I mean, this is the kind of shit that, am I allowed to say shit? I guess so. It's a podcast, right? Like this, you just wonder from time to time, and I'm sincere in saying this, Charlie. I actually do wonder when I hear things like that if there are folks on the left who want Donald Trump to stay in office, if they want him to remain president, if they don't want to beat him in November, because it's almost easier for them in some sense to pursue their ideological agenda if they have him as a foil.
You know, I actually was toying with the idea of writing a sort of an absurdist parody of all of this, you know, saying, you know, let's abolish the fire department. I mean, let's defund the fire department because we shouldn't have fire, because fire is racist, because it's unfair. And so if we would just simply envision a world without fire, then we wouldn't need to have fire. But then I realized the parody doesn't work because you can't do better than this woman who's talking about envisioning a world without police. Seriously. So, yes, it is not. Speaking of, am I going to get an explicit rating here? You know, I've been working on not using the F-bomb. I was actually on a show with some evangelical ministers the other day, and I really had to restrain myself. It was bad. I did use the F-word fascist ones, but I didn't use it. But speaking of effing nuts, Trump, I mean, I know this seems old, Tim, but I try not to be numb by it. The president of the United States, in the midst of a global pandemic and financial meltdown with millions of Americans in the street, with all of the things that are happening in the world, is tweeting out this morning, Buffalo protester shoved by police could be an Antifa provocateur. 75-year-old Martin Gugino was pushed away after appearing to scan police communications in order to black out the equipment. And then hashtag OANN, the really, really bizarre Trumpian conspiracy theorist network. I watched. He fell harder than was pushed. Was aiming scanner. Could be a setup? Question mark. Okay, so I'm going to violate my own principle here. This is not just the normal Trumpian tweet. This is not just even the president throwing out bizarre conspiracy theories. This is fucking nuts. And it's the president of the United States. And I don't know, you know, what deeper dive or gloss to put on it, Tim.
Yeah, I don't either. Look, Charlie, there are moments in this presidency where, as desensitized as we've become to this just sort of unhinged, untethered from reality talk that you will hear from the leader of the free world, that will still nevertheless sort of make your neck snap and go, say, what?
Yeah.
Like, this is the kind of thing that you see on your Facebook feed from, like,
yeah,
your crazy old uncle who's been, like, living out in the woods for the last 15 or 20 years and who everybody sort of, walks on eggshells around at Thanksgiving, right?
Like, and it ran out of his meds.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, look, like, it's just, I'm always in a tricky position on conversations like this because he is the president of the United States and he does command this awesome office. And I want to be respectful of that office. And I want to try and be as fair and objective as a reporter as I can be. But it is just breathtaking to see the president of the United States dealing with sort of dual crises right now, the likes of which no president really in modern times has had to deal with during an election year. I mean, Bush had one crisis, he didn't have two. And here's the president tweeting that this 75-year-old guy is this rogue Antifa agent who was going to single-handedly take down the Buffalo PD, and that's why it was okay to knock him on his ass and watch the blood coming out of his ears. Like, it's just, I don't know what else to say except it's just like another episode of the Twilight Zone.
Yeah, and speaking of which, by the way, shout out to the Washington Post, which has done this amazing video reconstruction of what happened a week ago today. Or today's Tuesday, right? We could go yesterday, when they at Lafayette Park, when they used the gas, the pepper balls, the rubber bullets to move that crowd, and the way that the president has lied about it, the way his staff has lied about it, the way Bill Barr has lied about it. We're in a very, very strange situation right now. It is really bizarre. And I think it is hard to be just an objective reporter because, you know, this stuff is so incredibly nuts. Okay. So the other reason I wanted to talk to you today, Tim, I have a piece. I have a newsletter, and which is published in the Bulwark today, and I devote it to Mitt Romney and Mitt Romney's march. And I have to tell you, Tim, it was inspired by you.
Oh, good.
Your tweets, because you kind of had a head snapping moment there when you know there's Mitt Romney out there marching with Black Lives Matter activists, and it really, you know, I think you pointed out, you know, this is a guy who has been reviled for years by Democrats. He's, you know, exiled by Republicans, but his place in history is going to be very different than his public perception at the moment. Am I capturing one of the things one of your reactions?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, the way that I had phrased it, I think, Charlie, was just that I can't think of any politician for whom there's going to be a bigger delta between how they are perceived in contemporary political culture versus how they will be viewed in the history books. And, you know, Romney, look, and none of this is to defend Romney. I mean, it's been remarkable to watch all of these, all of these hot takes, for lack of a better way of putting it, about how, oh, yeah, did you forget that this was the guy who sought out Donald Trump's endorsement? Did you forget that this was the guy who talked about 47% of Americans being takers? This is the guy who flip-flopped on gay marriage and everything? No, of course not. Yeah. Like, and this is somehow, some way, people are assuming that, like, I have, or that anybody who praises Mitt Romney for this has this sort of binary view of politicians, that they're either good or they're bad. No, at a baseline, most of these people are never to be trusted. And we understand that. And they make mistakes and they say stupid things and they do things that they wish they hadn't done, and they live and hopefully they learn and they improve upon themselves and their past, you know, shortcomings. But Mitt Romney, I think more than certainly anybody in the Republican Party, is determined to learn from those mistakes and to do better. And he should be applauded for that. And when people want to never let go of those shortcomings, when they never want to let this man live them down, it just feels to me like, A, there's just this sort of terrifying lack of grace in our culture, but B, there's no shortage of irony, Charlie, in how some of these folks are ignoring the lessons of Trump's rise to power. Namely, that when you're willing to demonize Mitt Romney and you're willing to successfully paint him as this scary, terrible person, not just as a politician, not as policy, right, but as a person, you are willing to successfully scare people away from him. You know what? It's going to work once, but it's not going to work twice. People start to tune you out. People become desensitized to it. And that, as much as anything else, is the lesson of Trump's rise to power, is that people were just not willing to be scared anymore.
Well, and that's not an excuse, and that's not an alibi, but it's a reality. And I lived through that as well, that if you call everybody a racist, when the real thing comes along, people are going to be numb to it. Right. And, you know, and look, I agree with you. I mean, I think that, you know, Mitt Romney's made a lot of mistakes. He's flip-flopped on a lot of things, but he's a fundamentally decent moral man. And you go back to the 2012 campaign and see what was said about him, you know, that he was a charlatan, that Joe Biden said he's going to throw you all back in chains, implied he was a felon, questioned his patriotism. And, you know, I am struck by the fact that Mitt Romney himself does not seem to be carrying the load of bitterness. But that was a signal to a lot of Republicans: no more Mr. Nice Guy. They hate us. They're going to say anything about us. And when they accuse us of being crooks or racist, we're just going to blow it off. So there is a through line from that, the lesson that Republicans thought they learned from that to get to Donald Trump. So just a reminder, as we watch the fundamental decency of Mitt Romney out there, remember how he was demonized and what he was said. And I noticed that you got some pushback. Well, no, it was no worse than any other campaign. And you basically called bullshit on that, saying, no, even at the time, people were saying this is one of the nastiest, most personal campaigns we'd ever seen. So if you can do that to a Mitt Romney, you know, don't then come back and say, hey, whatever happened to civility in politics?
Exactly. Well, and that's the thing, Charlie, is, look, you know, we all recognize that politics ain't beanbag, as the old saying goes, and that you're going to have some ugliness inherent to any campaign for high office, particularly for the presidency. And I think it's not to coddle Mitt Romney. It's to make a broader point that, you know, there were opportunities in that campaign. You know, trust me, Charlie, I've reported on this. There were people who came to Romney repeatedly, right-wingers, but people who had been very much a part of the Republican ecosystem who had his ear and who had the ear of the National Republican Party when he was the nominee, who wanted Romney to get really ugly against Obama and run a really sort of identity-driven campaign and question his patriotism and really sort of flirt with some of the nativist nasty instincts that we saw come out, you know, 4 years later. And Romney refused to do it. I mean, look, you can criticize the way that he ran his campaign. And yes, he made a stupid joke about, you know, nobody found my birth certificate. But like, ultimately, when Romney was presented time and again with an opportunity to go really dark against Barack Obama, he didn't do it. And I think that he deserves a certain degree of credit for that. And Democrats did not give him that same degree of respect. I mean, what Joe Biden said about Mitt Romney, what Harry Reid said about Mitt Romney, what Stephanie Cutter said about Mitt Romney, I mean, that, I think it objectively went beyond just regular rough and tumble, you know, bare knuckle politics. I mean, this, it struck me anyway as something that was a little bit beyond that. And it was in service consistently of this attempt to paint him as a bad human being, not just a bad politician with bad policies, but a bad person. And when you do that to somebody like Mitt Romney, who I think we all recognize is not a bad person, then you blow your credibility at a time, at a later time when you really need it.
You know, the piece I wrote this morning, I quote some of the things he said to McKay Coppins, or what Romney told McKay Coppins, that he doesn't think he's an historical figure. He doesn't think that history is going to pay any attention to him. But, you know, look, there's a reality that there comes a point in your life when you do start thinking about where you came from, his father, George Romney, and you start thinking about how you're going to be remembered. Clearly, Romney's there right now. I thought that his vote to convict Trump was a legacy-defining moment. I thought at the time it was. But I actually do think, and I think you're kind of getting to this point, though, that Sunday represented something more, because his decision to march wasn't just a challenge to Trump. I mean, it really did defy generations of conservative orthodoxy and denial on this. So, I mean, if the arc of history for the Republican Party ever does shift, which I don't know whether it will, this is going to be one of those moments. So it is a significant moment in Republican politics that's just different from standing up against Donald Trump.
I think that's right, Charlie. And I would also add to that, you know, Tim Scott is someone who has played obviously a really interesting role. I mean, he's the only Black Republican senator, and he's the only Black person ever in the history of the Republic to serve in both chambers of Congress, both the House and the Senate. I mean, this is someone who is very thoughtful on issues of race and who is very reserved, who thinks long and hard before he says anything. But remember, a few years ago, he finally had enough, and he got up on the Senate floor and gave this unbelievable speech where he went into detail talking about all the times that he had been racially profiled, how he'd been pulled over seven times in 1 year as an elected official, how he'd been stopped by the Capitol Police and questioned despite being a U.S. senator. And Tim Scott, I think, in some sense, has begun to, you know, ever so slightly wedge open the door for other Republicans, for white Republicans specifically, to come out and speak to these things. I was really struck in a conversation I was having with Ben Sasse last week, and I quoted just a short part of that conversation in my piece.
Yeah.
Ben Sasse talked about growing up in a really homogenous town in Nebraska, but he started playing travel sports as he got older, and he made friends with some Black guys that he played sports with, and how one of his really good buddies was a Black guy, and that when they got their driver's licenses at the same time, Ben Sasse was telling me, it had never occurred to him until that point that these guys lived in completely different worlds, that Ben Sasse never had to worry about being pulled over and harassed or potentially brutalized because of the color of his skin, but that was something that his buddy had to live with every single day. And Sasse talked really eloquently about how this made a really searing impression on him, and that now, you know, Tim Scott's one of his best friends in the Senate. Now, he said he goes and talks with Scott constantly about these issues and is really thinking them over. And he started to toe up to that line, talking about systemic issues and institutional inadequacies. And so I think Ben Sasse is a guy to keep an eye on moving forward. And there will be some other Republicans. It's not going to happen overnight. It's going to be gradual. But there are going to be some conversations happening now on the Republican side, Charlie, that were unimaginable just 5 or 10 years ago.
So on Romney, here's a question for you, because I know you know this sort of thing. Where's Paul Ryan?
Well, you're the Wisconsin guy. I should be asking you this.
Yeah, but you're the guy that talks to him still.
Yeah, you know, so Ryan gave a pretty good statement last week to the, I think it was to the Journal Sentinel, to
Craig Gilbert.
Yeah, Craig Gilbert, the great reporter out there. And Craig posted it online, and it was a very sort of, you know, George W. Bushian statement. It was kind of hitting those same notes. And, you know, we need to examine our failures as a country, which, of course, again, is what got Bush beaten up so badly. I think Ryan would like to just come out and say more at a time like this, Charlie. I really do. Matter of fact, I know that he would.
Yeah.
But I think Ryan has gained a certain degree of self-awareness since leaving office, and he recognizes that a lot of people just don't want to hear from him. That on the right, he'll get beat up because everybody thinks he's gone soft and that he's just a pansy and he was never with Trump anyway and he's a rhino. And people on the left think that, you know, he let Trump turn the presidency into a dictatorship and they don't want to hear from him either. So, you know, Ryan, I think, has really decided just to lay low and that there's very little to be gained by speaking out. But in a way, that's a shame because I think that he is a voice of reason, even if you like Romney. I mean, the guy made mistakes. He certainly wishes, I think, that he could have done a lot of things differently, but at his core is still a really decent person. And you need decent people to speak up at times like this. And you know, unfortunately, I don't think we'll be hearing a whole lot from him.
No, I think that's exactly his calculation, which is part of the tragedy of our times, because you know the role that he would be playing, you know, if in fact he was still, quote unquote, relevant in the Republican Party. I mean, this his the trajectory of his whole career was to take a stand at a moment like this. But then, of course, Trump came along. By the way, just the, sort of as a digression or parenthetically, his decision to sort of lay low and, you know, maybe until this period passes, and I assume that he'll find his voice at some point, although he is, I should note, on the Fox News board of directors. And at some point, you know, he might want to weigh in on some things that are happening on Fox News. But the contrast between his approach and, say, Scott Walker's approach here in Wisconsin is so dramatic. Scott Walker continues to become more Trumpy every single day. And I don't know whether you follow him on Twitter, but let's say he's not enhancing his intellectual reputation by constantly tweeting out things that look like they were written by Charlie Kirk. So when I watch Walker's Twitter feed, I have a grudging respect for Paul Ryan's reticence. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, Charlie, what do you, you know, let me turn the tables for a moment. What do you make of Walker specifically? Because, you know, when I see a lot of Republicans, you know, saying or doing or tweeting things that are sort of servile in nature like that to Trump, you know, I kind of understand the play, but I guess I really had, and maybe it's naive, but I really had sort of turned the page on Scott Walker as a national entity. And maybe that's a big mistake. I mean, obviously, when he dropped out in 16, there was a lot of talk that he was doing this to preserve his future opportunities. Do you see him as a guy who's right back in 24?
No, not at all. You know, he's already got that job as head of the Young Americas Foundation, which is a very considerable job. He doesn't take over for a year. And I don't know what the donor profile is there. Because he could certainly keep his head down, work on just general conservative issues without engaging in the kinds of things that he's engaging. I don't know that he's thinking of actually running, but he's got a platform. He's got a place there. So he wants to be in the mix. But he's also made it clear that he doesn't have ambitions here in Wisconsin. There were a lot of people who thought he might run for governor again or for United States Senate. Apparently that's not in the cards. So I honestly don't know. I don't know. And, you know, if I could talk to people who have his ear at the moment, I would tell them just, again, take away his phone. Just stop at this point. Because he's a young man. I mean, look, I go back with him so far that I remember when he was running for governor in 2006. And he dropped out of that race because it was tough. But he dropped out knowing he was going to keep his powder dry for 2010.
Right,
and he and I discussed that in great depth and at length, which was that was a very calculated maneuver by him. It was one of the smartest things he ever did, dropping out of that race. 4 years later, he was elected governor. When he dropped out early in the presidential race, he had that model very, very much in mind. I mean, he was at that moment, but I don't think he saw the way that what was going to happen with Trump, but what his identity is at this moment. I mean, how does he distinguish himself from any other Trump sycophant at the moment? How does he stand out? What is his distinctive element? And he hasn't even sort of kept his credibility intact as Paul Ryan has, or is attempting to do.
Yeah, I guess that's the question that comes to mind whenever you see someone really cozying up to Trumpism is, you know, is this part of a long-term play to attempt to succeed him atop the party, and you know, because to do so you're going to need some really significant chunk of the MAGA revolution on your side? Or is it just to sort of be relevant in the moment and to, you know that this is a ride that's going to come to an end at some point, but geez, it's a hell of a lot of fun and you want a front row seat? I mean, I don't know. But you know, certain people obviously have, you know, I mentioned Will Hurd earlier. Like, you know, that's a guy who I think has a pretty good beat on the model that's going to be necessary in the post-Trump era, which is, look, like, you know, give the guy praise for the things he did right, understand the insecurities he was speaking to in the electorate, you know, understand that there are some things that you're going to want to replicate, at least from a policy perspective, but then also understand that this stuff is just totally unsustainable and that you have to be able to sort of thread this needle and expand the appeal of the party and restore some sense of normalcy. And people who are sort of almost slavishly giving themselves over to Trump in these last few years, I think that they're just going to have completely robbed themselves of the ability to thread that needle, to straddle those two universes in the way that maybe a Will Hurd will be able to.
No, I agree. So one last question, because I know we've gone on for a while. There was a big story in the New York Times about all the Republicans that were not going to be supporting Donald Trump. The ones who are staying silent, you know, some of them won't support Trump, but are reluctant to endorse Biden. Interesting, they asked both Boehner and Ryan for comments, and neither one of them commented. Somebody asked me about that, whether or not they would endorse Biden, and I said, possibly Boehner, no way Ryan, because Ryan would understand that would blow him up forever. There's no coming back from an endorsing Biden, but Boehner maybe. What do you think? What would you say if you were asked that question? Well, I'm asking that question.
Yeah, I agree with you on Ryan because of the Fox News situation. Right. I just don't see any way of that happening. I'd be pretty surprised if Boehner did too. Just because, you know, I talked about this when Lamar Alexander was retiring. Obviously he is retiring, but there was all this speculation, Charlie, that, well, geez, he clearly doesn't like Trump. He clearly views Trump as an affront to all of his values. And, you know, maybe he will cast the vote to impeach or to at least get more evidence for the trial or whatever. And I try to explain to people, you know, this isn't just about retiring. It's about your sort of community. And for a guy like Lamar Alexander and for a guy like John Boehner, you know, you spend your entire political life and then post-political life in Boehner's case, sort of surrounded by a lot of these people who think the same way and who have the same loyalties, cultural and political and otherwise. And you're kind of taking a risk of a breach there, of a rupture, if you're going to come out and do something that dramatic. And Boehner's not a guy who's prone to dramatics. So I'm not totally ruling it out, but I'd be awfully surprised if he decided to do that.
Well, but he does seem to sort of like be all out of bleeps to give. I mean, isn't he like basically a lobbyist for the pot industry now?
Oh, yeah. No. Look, I mean, but I think there's a difference between being out of bleeps to give and being willing to sort of subject yourself. I mean, look, Boehner's living a pretty comfortable life, right? He's playing golf 6 days a week, and he serves on a couple of these boards and calls in for, you know, dials into conference calls a few times a week. And he's, you know, going to sleep every night after a couple of glasses of Merlot, and he's a happy man. Does he really want to, you know, get inundated with death threats and have people showing up at his door screaming, you know, MAGA at him? I don't know. I mean, I don't know that he wants that kind of disruption in his life.
No, I agree. Say, Tim, thank you so much for coming back. Appreciate it very much. The article you have to read is in the Politico magazine. Is this the last stand of the law and order Republicans, a punitive brand of conservatism embraced by Trump and some GOP hardliners, is rapidly falling out of step with public opinion? Always one of our most valuable guests on the podcast. Tim, thanks for coming back.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks, guys.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.